And again, we'll be covering in our Wednesday night class, whatever is preached on this evening, we will cover in more depth Wednesday night. Excuse me here while I try and find it. We're going to be in Ecclesiastes 4 this evening. If you remember 2 weeks ago where we left this off, we had finished the third chapter. And kind of a bird's eye view so far of what we have seen in Ecclesiastes. In chapter 1, we have seen the writer despair. The first question he asks is in verse 3 of chapter 1, what does man gain by all the toil and all his labor? And the implied answer in that is nothing. There is no surplus in life. There's nothing you get to take with you. There's nothing that at the end of when it's all said and done, you get handed a welcome basket or something. There's no lasting legacy in the real sense of the term, because part of the wisdom literature of the Old Testament is it combines blunt, hard statements with poetic prose. So we have the blunt, hard statement there in verse 3. He spends the rest of the chapter going on a poetic exposition of that, of looking at, he just looks at all creation. A generation comes, a generation goes. The sun rises, the sun sets. The wind comes and it goes. It circles the life, as it were. It keeps on coming and going. He said there's no remembrance of former things, and there will be no remembrance of former things. Again, some of the applied stuff there is, in the grand scheme of things, of life under the sun, my great-great-great-grandchildren, my descendants, will probably not know of me. I might be just a name. And I can tell you right now that as far as our family history is concerned, I only know the names to my great-grandparents. I know there's a great-great-great-grandparent. I don't know her name. And beyond that, I don't know any of my ancestors. And I know the temptation for chapter 1 is to try and dress it up and make it a blessing. It's not supposed to be. Ecclesiastes is the mirror into reality. And we're supposed to be shocked by the bluntness of the author in chapter 1. And granted, it gets kind of worse in chapter 2. But as he looks at all the paths of life that he has taken, he has tried to find meaning through knowledge, through degrees, of lining his study with the achievements of life. And he found that to be a hollow pursuit. So he said, he ran from the universe. He said, well, if knowledge isn't any good, then I'm going to take to the town. Eat, drink, and be merry. I'm going to have a good time, see all the shows, drink until my heart's content. And you can almost see the author waking up Saturday morning with a beating head and realizing this, too, has no meaning. And so he considered a wise life, a life lived in wisdom. And he said, yes, it is more profitable than a life of folly. But his vexing issue with on that life is that the wise man and the foolish man both end up in the same place. They both have the same end. And so he despaired. What point is there of living a good, righteous life if at the end of my life the same thing happens to me as the foolish man who didn't live a wise life? And so he goes into this downward spiral of despair towards the end of the chapter, chapter 2. But then at the end of chapter 2 is when the light begins to dawn. And this book, which tends to be a little bit depressing to begin with, starts making more sense. He says in verse 24, chapter 2, there is nothing better for a man to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen is from the hand of God. For who can eat and have enjoyment without him? So now we're entering God into the perspective of the book. And make no mistake, the author in 24 is not paraphrasing the Stoic philosophy of eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die. He's seen eat, drink, and be merry, not because that's all there is, but because that is what there is. The author's trying to get us to understand that life is not a means to an end. All the things I have in this life are not meant for me to use to try and get me to another spot, to use to my own advantage. They're meant to be enjoyed for what they are. I think most of us have probably had the experience of a person in our life that basically the only time the phone rang or they came to see us was because they wanted something. It was a friendship in name only. There's individuals in life that go through life like that. That be it their relationships, their family, their work, everything, it's all a means to an end. How can I use this to get what I want? And the writer's telling us that's not the way to live life. That's a life that's futility. That's a life of striving after the wind. That's a life that is bitter and unsatisfying. And so we go into chapter 3 and talk about a time for everything. In the first 9-8 verses, he gives kind of a broad perspective of all the perplexing seasons of life and how really we're not in control of any of those seasons. None of us got to choose when we fell in love and found our spouse. Some of us, we would have done if we could choose, we would have done a lot sooner. And perhaps some of us here this evening, if we had the choice, we would have waited until we're a lot older. No one gets to choose when you go into the house of mourning. No one gets to choose when blessings come into your life. These are all things that just happen to us, and we are enclosed in time's boundaries. And remember from the last time we met and we talked about this, chapter 3 teaches two important lessons. The first being is we are linear time beings, that we are encased in time and we can't control that. And the second lesson is that God is not. And so, yes, we've been looking at how life under the sun, no one really cares. We are but a drop in the bucket, life underneath the sun. But when God enters the picture, that really doesn't matter. You look in the end of chapter 3 and the verse 17, verse 16 rather. Furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there was wickedness, and the place of righteousness there was wickedness. I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man, for a time for every matter and every deed is there. There is a time to kill, there is a time to make peace, there's a time for war, there's a time for mourning, there's a time for rejoicing. There is also a time for judgment. And why life under the sun is full of perplexing, I'm lost for words here, paradoxes, there we go. That seasons that make no sense to us, and we don't get to choose when these things happen to us, and there's great injustices and oppression found in this life. We can take comfort in the fact that while according to the world we may not matter, while according to the world they could care less about the injustices or the oppression that happens, we know that we serve a God that at the end of time every wrong will be righted. And while the world may not think and my supposed future generations may not remember who I am, God does. God remembers. You look in verse 15, chapter 13, chapter 3, he says, that which has been already, and that which will be has already been. For God seeks what passes by. We forget. The world erases. God brings back. God will bring back into account everything. And so going into this, chapter 3 ends in the middle of a thought here. But we pick up in chapter 4, the author says, then I observed, or then I looked again, at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulate the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. But better off that both of them is than the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun. Now, that sounds very bleak. I'm not going to lie about that. I'm not going to try and dress that up. And this is where another part where I do not believe and I do not think this book, Ecclesiastes, is talking about a life lived without God. That's too simplistic of an answer. Solomon is pointing out the world as it is, which is incredibly sinful and distorted and corrupt. And as Christians, we can learn something from that. Now, it is hard for us and it's uncomfortable for us. It's uncomfortable for me to stare long into the face of reality. That's why we have diversions. That's why after watching a horror movie recently, I had to turn on cartoons afterwards just to give myself that distraction. That's why news programs every night tend to end with a funny clip of an animal or something. Little side note, I never got the evening news. They would say good evening and they would give you a whole list of reasons why it isn't a good evening. And then they try and make it better with some sort of video at the end. That's why we seek distraction from things. And distraction is good at times. That's why there are pleasures and blessings in life, because we would all go mad if we had to look at reality as it is all the time. The oppression, the injustice. But he looks at this and he's so full of despair, he goes, it's almost, the dead are better off almost, because they don't have to deal with this anymore. And he says, even better off are the ones who have not yet existed, because they have not even had to deal with this at all. But Ecclesiastes 4 raises a question then. And it raises a perspective or a new question to ask ourselves is, where am I going in life? What is my focus? Because the wisdom right here, admittedly, you read those first three verses, he's very inwardly focused. In fact, throughout this whole book so far, it's been about him in a sense. And he assumes that that's our default way of thinking as well. If we were to put a blowhorn on your thoughts, have it projected to the world all day, I and me and myself would be a very frequent set of words used. I know every day between the window of 11 o'clock and 2 o'clock, it hits me different every day. I go, I'm hungry. How can I fix that? Throughout the day, I'm asking myself, am I happy? Am I okay? How am I feeling right now? I'm sure if we were all honest with ourselves, we think about the same thing. And some of this is innocent stuff. Don't get me wrong. Some of it's just natural urges. We get hungry, we say, I'm hungry. I'm going to go fulfill that need. But we go through life thinking about me a lot. We become inwardly focused. Gibson, on that book in Ecclesiastes, in this fourth chapter, he writes, people fill their thoughts and plans with themselves as they constantly work out how to navigate the world in a way that will give them meaning and happiness. And no better way to illustrate this is when it comes to how people approach Bible teaching sometimes, or how some individuals operate within a local congregation. I'm speaking in generalities here, so remember, exceptions, and I'm not trying to single out anyone here this evening. Sometimes people will approach Bible teaching as, well, how does that work for me? Or what am I getting out of the service? In our Hebrews class, we made this point that sometimes people only judge the quality of a Bible class or a sermon by how applicable it was to their lives. Don't get me wrong, application is very important. We need to know how the Scripture applies in our life and how does that look. But you can't have application without proper doctrinal understanding. And if you're focusing on nothing but application, which is really how does this work for me, if that's your sum total of focus, it's going to result in a very shallow understanding of Scripture. But on a larger scale, think about that, that's a very consumer mentality. You know, you can think of that idea. Do you come to services, taking services for a moment as an example, do you come to services to serve or to be served? And unfortunately, our culture's attitudes has created a subculture of the fact that we expect to be served in every aspect of our lives, and no less in worship to God. This is evident too, just for a quick example, our taste in song leading. Well, he led that too slow. I don't like that song. The pitch was off. Okay, is that really the important thing? Is that what matters? Or are you focusing more on your inward needs? And this is all one large way of trying to explain this, is this, we think very much of ourselves. And Ecclesiastes challenges us, instead of thinking about me, to begin to start thinking about we. That is why, it's one of the reasons why many of you have asked me about this. When I'll greet one of you, I don't say, how are you doing today? I say, how are we doing today? And granted, part of it is just reaction and habit now at this point, but you think of the phrasing of the question. How are you doing puts the ball in your court so you can focus on yourself. How are we doing immediately makes a connection and thinks of the collective. Oftentimes in church problems, the problems stem from what I perceive ought to be done and how I feel, instead of asking the question, well, how are we doing? You know, you take a lesson on first principles, for example. Well, that didn't benefit me. Okay. That's thinking about me. Let's think about we for a moment. We have a lot of new Christians in this congregation, which is great. It's absolutely fantastic. We're growing. We have a lot of younger Christians who need to mature. So Sunday morning, it's the first principles lesson gets preached. So, okay, you may not get anything out of that, but that's focused on me. Let's think about we for a moment. We are a younger, spiritually speaking, congregation that needs to grow. So if I can think of the we in that situation, I'm like, okay, I may not get any new revelation in this sermon, but I know it's benefiting the congregation as a whole, because it's allowing younger Christians to get stronger. And it's a challenge to myself to try and find something new or maybe relay my own foundations. But Ecclesiastes 4 presents two ways of living life. And we're going to look at kind of the whole Bible picture here, and I got that, this idea comes from David Gibson, the whole Bible perspective of this chapter. And before I present those two ways, let's go to Matthew, the 22nd chapter. Jesus is presented with a question by one of the religious teachers of the day. Again, we're in Matthew chapter 22. Starting in verse 34. But when the Pharisees had heard that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered themselves together. One of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him. Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? And he said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. We're going to approach Ecclesiastes 4 tonight through that second commandment. There's two ways we can live life. The first is I can hate my neighbor and thus hate myself. Or maybe hate's not the right word. I can use my neighbor and thus hate myself. Or I can love my neighbor and love myself. So picking up there in verse 4 of Ecclesiastes 4. He says, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. One hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. The first section here, again, that first three verses, he sees oppression everywhere. Ecclesiastes shifts. We've gone from talking about evil and wickedness in a general sense, falling in a general sense, to a very specific type of evil here, and that is oppression. And that is using other people for your own gain. You can think of the tax collector in the ancient world who took way more than what was owed. And this is going to sound very weird. We should be very thankful for the IRS on the fact that it's a fixed percentage at each income tier. Taxes still are awful. But it's one of those things, it's a certainty in life. You can't escape the IRS or death. Those are the two inescapable forces in this life. In fact, I'm convinced if the government were to collapse tomorrow, April 15th, we would all get our tax bill. But the ancient world, it wasn't like that. You went to the tax booth at tax time, and they made up whatever they felt like that day. If you come on a bad day, you're paying 50% this year. Come on a good day, 45%. And it was expected of them that they would take an extra cut to line their own pockets. That was somebody oppressing weaker, at-risk countrymen for their own benefit. People who do things just because they can get away with it. And that's pretty much what comes down to a lot of the oppression that happens in this life, is they can get away with it. And so he sees that, he sees the oppression, and verses 5 through 6 deals with that as well. Now he's seen verse 4, he says, I have seen every labor and every skill which is done as the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. I like how the ESV says it. He says it, the skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. He's trying to keep up with the Joneses. And the only reason he's working hard and he's putting in extra hours at the office is just so he can one-up the Joneses. But here's the problem. You may be keeping up, trying to keep up with the Joneses. The Joneses are trying to keep up with the Smiths. And so on down the street. But so much of mankind's labor is to one-up. Do you know how the American space program began? The Soviets put Sputnik in space first. Like, we can't allow that to happen. We're going to put a man on the moon first. They put a satellite, a monkey, and a dog in space. We're going to put a man on the moon. And within a decade, we did it. That might be an oversimplification of history there, but what was the main cause there? It's like, oh, we can't let that happen. And this shows up in so many other places in life, but that's, in a sense, that's oppression. That's using people. You're using your job and other resources you have just to one-up. Trying to have a whole bunch of different friends so you can just brag about how many people you actually know. We look in verse 5, you have the opposite end. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Laziness is also hating my neighbor. Being slothful is being oppressive. Because I have nothing I can give my neighbor in their time of need. Laziness focuses on me, me, me completely. But the only problem is at the end of life, at the end of the day, when you have nothing left but yourself, you don't last very long by yourself. You won't be able to survive very long when the cupboards are bare and the fridge is empty. And you have no one left to depend upon. And so the writer's not being, he's not being melodramatic here. He's trying to give a vivid imagery to show us what laziness can do to an individual. The lazy man folds his own hands in a relaxed state. And by doing so, he's basically a cannibal with himself. He's sowing his own destruction. You know, oftentimes, I've said it too, the workaholics are always warned that at the end of your life, you're not going to wish you spent more hours at the office. But for the lazy man, as Gibson put it, at the end of his life, he's going to wish that maybe he spent at least some time at the office. He worked at least a little bit. and had something to show of it. But you see this, and you have the lazy man in verse 6, the last part of that verse 6, you have another extreme. You have the lazy man who folds his hands to his own destruction, but then you have, he says, one handful of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. This is where we as Christians actually fall, we're most at risk. Because we can mask our busyness, our striving after wind, having two fistfuls of labor and good deeds. In this section study and reading that book, this is something that, this is a section I will admit that I'm preaching mainly to myself here, but in preaching, for example, it is very easy to fill a 40, 50, 60 hour work week of doing nothing but good deeds and tasks without even touching sermons, classes, evangelism, any of that stuff. And it's the same thing for any Christian who's engaged in the good works. You can fill up an entire work week, you can fill two works week, work weeks worth of stuff. But the thing is, at the end of the day, there'll still be another person to visit. There'll still be another class to teach. There'll still be another prayer to pray. And this is not supposed to make us feel like, well, we shouldn't bother with any of this stuff. But if we're not careful, we can extend ourselves far too wide and burn ourselves out. And so I want to go to verse 6 here for a moment here. I like how the English Standard words it, it says, better is a handful of quietness than two handfuls full of toil and striving after wind. That word quietness there, it's not talking about the sign, you know, the sounds of an empty room. Quietness there, Gibson says it's a word that used to capture the deep well-being of those who know their place in the world. They're content with the boundary lines of their life, and they're able to enjoy the fruits of their labors with a cheerful heart. And the way to arrive at that place of rest is to live for we and not me. It's an individual who's found balance. He is engaged in the good works, make no mistake. He has found the balance between the lazy man who folds his hands to his own destruction and the individual who is stretched to the outermost limits and just seems to not have enough time in the day to get everything done. Is a person who is content with life and knows his lot, who has embraced that lot and embraced every blessing that God has given them. Balance can be had. And making the application to service of each other. Yes, we ought to be engaged in the praying and the visiting and the encouraging and whatever we can to build up and strengthen our brethren. But I may be saying this more for myself, but I must say it for everybody. You are not the entire congregation. You can't do it all by yourself. That is why we are in a local body of believers. That's why passages like Ephesians 4:11 through the end of the chapter exist, that God gave some as apostles and teachers and prophets. For what purpose? For the equipping of the body. One person can't fulfill all those roles. One person can't do all the visiting. No one's expecting you to do all that stuff. What is expected is do what you can. Accept the lot and live a life of quietness, as Ecclesiastes is trying to teach us. We all have a part to play. But you know, my foot is not expected to do the work of both my feet, my legs, and my hands. He's expected to do the work that he's designed to do. So we have those two extremes, and really those two extremes are hindrance because on the busyness side, even if it's in good works, you're no good to anybody if you're burned out. And this is the hidden time bomb in most preachers' lives if they don't get a balance struck. As many of them burn out decades before they should have. My friend Ryan knew of another preacher that because of how manically busy he was and how much he was taking on upon himself, just kind of snapped. Got up in the middle of the night, just walked out of his house and kept walking. Now, he came back later, but he didn't preach for years after that. And the same thing happens to, the same temptation, the same risk is there for everybody if we are engaged in manic busyness without appreciating the rest, without trying to find the balance in our own lives. And so we have the other avenue that we can approach life and how we can live life. Starting in verse 7, it says, "Then I looked again at vanity under the sun. There was a certain man without dependent, having neither son nor brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, and for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? This too is vanity, and it is a grievous task. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one who one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lay down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart." So we have, the writer gives an illustration. Here we have this very successful individual. He wants for nothing, but he's alone in this life. He has no one to share his labors in. He's like the man who sets out a giant feast. We're coming up on Thanksgiving. Imagine a very large table, the dining room the size of this auditorium, table going up the entire middle. It could feed a good 100 or so people, and it's all set. He has spared no expense. Bought the name brand stuffing, Stouffer's. Has two turkeys on the table. But it's just him. At no point in all his labor did he ever think to ask, "Who am I working for?" It's interesting how things intersect. I'm doing another study right now in another book on how we are actually made for friendship. That actually in the Garden of Eden, the first thing that God saw that was not good was the fact that man was living alone. And before he pronounces that all creation was very good, he creates man a companion. Adam and Eve were first friends, and I don't mean friends and they got married. The primary purpose of that creation to begin with was companionship. That was the basis of their marriage, of the first marriage. But we were created for community, for friendships. In fact, the ancients viewed friendship as the highest of all loves that anyone could ever enter into. And here we have a man who has no friends, has no dependents, has no wife, has no children. And so really the question is, what is his labor for? And the writer brings up this illustration to make the point that life is better in community. Life is better shared. So we're introduced a new thing here. We've been talking about how life needs to be enjoyed for what it is instead of what we think it ought to be. And as we're enjoying the pleasures of this life, the blessings of this life, for whatever season we may have them for, as we enjoy them, we need to share them. Because it's by sharing that actually, and thinking of we instead of me, that actually I gain a whole another level of blessing. My life is enriched from the people that are in my life. I get to share in the good fortune that I have been blessed with, and I get to pass that good fortune on to others. It's not a handout, it's not a hand up, it's not any of that. It's just enjoying and sharing the blessings that God has given individuals. It is a very sad person in this life who has no friends, has no companions of any kind. And it's a very sad life that is lived only for me, when it could be lived for we. You consider this whole section here, he's looking at all the evil and oppression, and it's people living for themselves and what they can get and take from people. And so what they can help and give to individuals. Ecclesiastes 4 presents us with a challenge, an application. Imagine how our relationships, just for example, would change if we just started asking, how are we doing, a little bit more often than how am I doing? I think a great example of this is a television show I watch from time to time. The husband had started a new company, and he's having to drive a city away on weekends and stuff to work and work, and it puts a strain on the marriage where they end up in marriage counseling, and it's a group counsel, so there's two counselors, and they separate the husband and wife through separate sessions, and the husband's counselor, the husband's telling the guys, like, if she can just hold on a little bit longer, it'll all be worth it. The counselor says to him, well, how much is a little bit longer? And he just kind of sits back and never considered that before, because he was thinking about what he wanted and just assuming that's what his wife would want. That was a situation where perhaps he would have asked, how are we doing, a little bit sooner, perhaps they wouldn't have had to work out that rough patch there. And that can be applied to every friendship, every relationship, every marriage, every relationship you can think of. In fact, most importantly, can be applied to our relationship with God. You think about asking that question of my walk with the Lord. How are we doing? You think of that collectively and think about some of the things we talked about this morning. How are we doing? Am I helping or hindering the work of the kingdom? Am I putting the needs of the kingdom and the needs of God before myself? Am I living for the ultimate we, Jehovah, or am I living for myself? Now, I can't make the applications for you in every which way. This is one of those lessons that I think the application will be too personable for me to try and make a general application of it. But there's so many different ways we can end up living for me instead of we. As we bring this to a close here in the 13th verse, he said, a poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. Or you go back to verse 6. Better is a handful of quietness than two handfuls full of toil and striving after the wind. If we can just start learning to live life, asking that question a little bit more, we can start not only enjoying life for what it is, but we can start sharing that and helping others enjoy life for what it is and sharing those blessings for whatever little time we may have here. For however much time we may have those blessings. Now, if you are not yet a Christian here this evening, the biggest blessing that you can ever receive is a relationship with Jesus Christ. To be washed free and clear of your sins. To be raised up and to walk in a new life, fully redeemed and fully forgiven. And that's a blessing that, despite the unpredictable seasons of life, that is a blessing that does not go away unless you choose to make it go away. Me having the blessing of ice cream, of a good meal, that's going to go away. The evidence is in my waistline. It's going to go away. My health may fail me. I will age. I will go more blind than I am now. All a whole bunch of stuff is going to fail me. A whole bunch of blessings are going to go away. A relationship with Jesus Christ never goes away. Jesus made it very simple for us. He that believes and is baptized shall be saved. He that believeth not shall be condemned. If you have need of salvation this evening, you need to be restored to the faith, please come forward and say, we stand and sing the song of invitation.
And press the battle ere the night shall veil the glowing skies. Against the foe in vales below, let all our strength be hurled. Faith is a victory we know that overcomes the world. Faith is the victory, faith is the victory. Oh, glorious victory that overcomes the world. His banner over us is love, the sword, the word of God. We tread the road the saints above with shout of triumph trod. By faith they like a whirlwind breath swept on o'er every field. The faith by which they conquer death is still our shining shield. Faith is the victory, faith is the victory. Oh, glorious victory overcomes the world. On every hand the foe we find drawn up in dread array. Let tents of peace be left behind and onward to the fray. Salvation's helmet on each head with truth all gird about. The earth shall tremble neath their tread and echo with our shout. Faith is the victory, faith is the victory. Oh, glorious victory that overcomes the world. Please be seated. If you were not able to be here this morning, the Lord's table is set before you now. Two gentlemen will come by. Just simply raise your hand and you can partake of the Lord's Supper. Sing together number 166, He Loved Me So.
Do me so. Why did my Savior come to earth and to the humble go? Why did He choose a lowly birth? Because He loved me so. He loved me so. He loved me so. He gave His precious life for me because